This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
I like to do on this program is analyze trends, and there is one trend that has been brewing for several years now, and now it's reached, I don't know if tipping point's the right word, it's reached an apex, which is the idea of adult children continuing to live at home. Recent study from the Pew Research Center reveals that less than half of adults aged 18 to 35 considered themselves financially independent from their parents. And a big part of that is continuing to live at home. A quick scan of the current economy, it helps explain why. There's a shortage of affordable housing, especially for first-time buyers, and that has a chilling effect on young adults. You know, I think of my sister, who I believe is 26 or 27, and she still lives with my father and stepmother. And my sister does very well. I think she might make more money than I make. And she's, you know, she's looking for a place that she can buy. And basically, until she finds a place that she can buy, she doesn't want to waste her money on, in her view, waste her money. I don't want to speak for her here, but waste her money on rent. And instead, she wants to squirrel away her savings until she can afford to put down a very generous down payment on an apartment or a building or a house that she really likes. So, you know, that's one example. But this has now become a big thing. A lot of young people, young adults, I want to be clear, we're talking about adults over the age of 18, younger than 35. They are struggling with student loan debt. A lot of them have student loan debt that is measured in five digits. The labor market does remain in something of a state of flux, and entry-level wages, especially for people that are just out of college, make independent living a challenge. So nearly a third of young adults in this age group, 18 to 35, currently live with at least one parent. Now, some of this might be due to the fact that some of those parents may need some help. Some of those parents may need to, may not be equipped to live on their own. That's a byproduct of the graying of America. But the percentage is even higher for 18 to 24-year-olds. 57% of them still live or at home. There was, throughout American history, this sink or swim at 18 mentality of earlier generations. And that is gone. That is gone. I know both categories. I know parents that have adult children living with them that I'm friends with the parents. And I know young adults that still live with their parents, that including some in my own family that I'm related to, that just because of the economic realities or sociological realities, that they are still living at home. And, you know, I don't think the temptation is to make a value judgment on this, that this is bad. Oh, these young kids, they want to stay at home till they're 27. And I recognize that mentality, and I recognize that there is this feeling that younger people are postponing adulthood more and more. They're kicking the can down the road. But I really think that's an overly simplistic view of the current conditions in the economy. because 40 or 50 years ago, it was not unusual to be able to either skip college entirely or go to or leave college and then be able to get a job that was going to allow you to support not only yourself, but a family. Now, I think that's very difficult. I think it's very difficult for many reasons, partly the cost of housing, partly because the wages haven't kept up with the cost of housing. I think a multitude of other factors as well. Is there some just today's 25-year-old is as mature as the 17-year-old from a former generation? Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I think it's an interesting dynamic. And I just wonder how that works. You know, let's say you're 25, 30 years old and you're going out on a date. What do? Do you bring that date home to your parents' house? I just also wonder how it is for a lot of these adults who have a 34 or 35-year-old living with them. So there is still a social stigma that remains concerning adult children who fail to launch into independence. And I just wonder how a lot of these parents and the millennials and the Generation Z children are finding ways to adapt to this new family dynamic. Because in some ways, this can be mutually beneficial, right? So the adult children can earn their keep, right? Parents can discover some benefits of what they call delayed empty nesting that they would otherwise be denied. So I'm reading this one article. I think this is from the Pew Research Center, or it's based on reporting from this data, where parents from previous generations often looked towards the day. They look forward to the day that their last child left one family home to start a new one. Late generation Xers and millennial parents are much more relaxed about emptying the nest. Many have a frame of reference regarding the economic challenges of young adulthood and the struggle to find a job in today's market. These parents are often more empathetic to their adult children who face difficult times. I'd love to hear from you if you're in this situation. If you're a young adult that happens to live at home with your parents, or if you're a parent that has a young adult, an adult child living with them, with you. I'd love to know really just how it's working out. 800-848-9222. Are there any instances where everybody is stepping on each other's toes? Are there instances where even though someone might be 30 years old, they still feel like a child? And they're still expected to obey certain rules that are more situated for a 15-year-old, like a curfew or having girls over or things of that nature. I'm curious how this is working out if you're in this situation. 800-848-9222. 45% of parents describe the living arrangements with their adult children as a positive step in the relationship, while an additional 29% said it was at least somewhat positive. Both parents and adult children have to, I would think, make some serious sacrifices to accommodate each other. But this overall family dynamic is something that I think is becoming increasingly the norm in 21st century America. Let me know what you think. 800-848-9222. Here is Jeffrey Arnett, who is a parent of adult children. I believe this was an interview he did with CNN. Who's a parent of adult children who live with him. Talked about the kind of the dynamic between he and his adult children.
I think there's often a step back in maturity and in development when they move back home, because we naturally slip back into the roles of parents for us and children for them.
Isn't that interesting? I buy that there's naturally a reduction, that's not the word he used, but it's my word, in maturity on the part of the children because you step back into those roles. I get that. I totally understand that. 800-848-9222. Here's Jeffrey Arnett.
We said, okay, you're adults. you're home now. Well, you're perfectly capable of doing the grocery shopping, doing the laundry, helping make meals, all the things that adults have to do on a daily basis.
I think that's interesting. All right. 800-848-9222. Tony is in Florida. Hi, Tony.
Good morning, Frank.
Morning.
I wanted to talk about cats, but can I make a comment about the living?
Sure, be my guest. It's your dime.
Okay. I turned 18 in 1977. I moved out the day I turned 18 and never looked back.
Well, that was the norm back then, right? I mean, that was almost what you were expected to do. If you didn't do that in the 70s, there was something considered very off about a situation, right?
Yeah, because even though my first jobs were minimum wage, I rented a 2-story house. I paid all my bills, and I didn't need like a roommate or anything, because that 410 bought way more than what minimum wage buys now.
Well, okay? And Tony, I'm so glad that you said that, because that's exactly the point that I was trying to articulate, which is that we look at these 20-year-olds, these 22-year-olds, these 25-year-olds, these 30-year-olds, and we think, oh, they're lazy, they're not independent, they're dealing with arrested development. But the reality is that an entry-level job, even if it wasn't a minimum wage job 40 or 50 years ago, that was enough to support yourself. And these days it's not. Wages have not kept up with the cost of living, let alone the cost of housing.
Exactly right. And I'm glad I was born then instead of now. and the second thing was, in my lifetime, I've had about 60 cats. And most of them have died from either an illness or old age. Take very good care of our cats. And we live in a forest, and people dump them out here. So almost all of our cats have been strays. And we just plunk them in the middle of our other cats, and they sink or swim. But I found that if you want to get a really good-natured cat, get an orange tabby. They have the absolute best temperament, the most personality. They're the best cats around. And they're all boys, because there's no female orange tabbies. But if you can get your hands on a tabby, an orange tabby, get one. And if you, how old's your cat that's still alive?
I believe she's 8.
Okay. So she's a little bit older, but most cats, no matter what their age, it's a lot easier to bring in a kitten or a cat under a year old. The younger the cat you bring in, the easier it is for them to accept them.
Well, Tony, thank you. Go ahead. Go finish your thought.
I was going to say, another thing is separate them, like put the new cat in a bedroom for a couple days.
No, I get that. My wife is, she really knows her stuff when it comes to cats. She works with cats a great deal. Tony, thank you for the call. I'll be honest, I am not eager to get another cat right now, given the difficulty that we had the last time that we had the two cats in the house. I would prefer for at least a little while to have just the one, but I really do think that this is probably an important thing for my wife, and maybe Prissy would be less lonely if we find the right cat. Hey, you know, it just so happens I came across this article about the percentage of households that are multi-generational, and it turns out that a large percentage of the U.S. population lives in these multi-generational households, meaning they live with three or more generations under one roof. Where are people most likely to live with older and younger adults, and what are the demographics of those families? Well, it varies. But in 2022, about 8.1% of the U.S. population lived in multi-generational households. That's 4.8 million households with 26 million people. Up to 19.9% of all Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander households were multi-generational, the most of any racial demographic group. American Indian, that's the next most, 14.9%. Then it's Asians, then it's Hispanics. So it does seem like Hawaiians, American Indian, and immigrants, whether they're Asian or Hispanic, are much more likely and willing, honestly, to have grandma live there, the parents live there, and the kids all under one roof, whereas it's only 5% of white households that have three or more generations under one roof. I think it's interesting. Hey, we're going to talk about Martin Van Buren coming up in a few minutes, but first let me say hello to Richard in Washington. Hi, Richard.
Love your show.
Thanks, Richard. Hey, do me a favor. Can you turn your radio off?
Son of a gun.
Richard, I'm gonna put you on hold and try and turn your radio off if you can. We'll go to one other caller. And Matt, if you could just remind folks to turn their radio off. Timothy in Brooklyn, what did you want to say?
Hey, good morning, Mr. Frank. I'm going to make this quick.
Sure.
I just want to say I enjoy your show as well. And pertaining to multi-general families and kids that don't want to leave the nest, you know, a lot of parents are not preparing their kids for the future. I say that to say, and I'm not a parent, but I raise many nieces and nephews. You have to prepare your children in stages. It's like, okay, when you become a teenager, you know that you're going to have to get a summer job. That's going to prepare you for the future of work and responsibility down the line. And at the same time, that one day, mommy and daddy are not going to be here, and you're going to have to hold your own. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. And I think that's a big part of what we're seeing. I think part of it, though, is what the previous caller, Tony, alluded to, that an entry-level job doesn't pay the bills like it used to in the 70s.
Trust me, I understand that. Look, I'm pushing 60 years old, and you already know what generation I'm from. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, okay, for today's generation, you really need, like, a master's degree. But college education has gotten so expensive and ridiculous. It's like these kids, well, I can become an influencer and break the bank.
Yeah, you're right. You're right about that, Timothy. Thank you. Try again to say hello to Richard. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how's it going? I'm sorry I had my radio
it's
up.
All good, Richard. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to kind of share how I'm kissing goodbye to a 30-year-old son, and my 40-year-old daughter is moving in. And I'm going... We had a big talk tonight about her moving in because she can't afford the crap hole that she's in. And they won't fix the plumbing. They won't fix the electrical. And I'm going, you know, as a dad, you're going, you know, I'll help you out however I can. But,
Richard,
it's so stupid how society has got to this point.
Oh, I agree with you, Richard. I talk a lot about this, and this is one issue that I don't think should be a partisan issue at all. I mean, your dollar doesn't stretch as much as it used to. And now, the way you're describing the situation, and obviously I can sense that you're sharing your daughter's anguish here. It doesn't sound like you're necessarily too thrilled to have your daughter moving back in. Is that accurate?
No, you are accurate. But I said, listen, we're going to have to lay down some rules. And yeah, we'll see how long that lasts. But I'm going, you're limited to 10-minute showers.
Oh, see.
And she has my grandson. And, you know, I can't just shove her out into the street.
Of course not. Right. So is your grandson going to be moving in with you as well?
Yes.
Wow. So this is going to be a sitcom you have going on there, Richard. That's going to be interesting.
I'll send you videos.
Please do. Hey, Richard, let me ask you, though, just logistically, I understand the and obviously you hope everyone's respectful enough of everyone else to, you know, with the showers and bathrooms and everything, that it doesn't turn into an issue. But what are you going to do if she takes an 11-minute shower or a 12-minute shower?
I'm gonna yell.
Yeah.
I said, everybody gets 10-minute showers. I'm in and out in 6 minutes.
Yeah, Richard, I have to run because we're going to talk Martin Van Buren with historian Ted Widmer in just a minute. But I think that's where it becomes a little curious for me, is how do you work that out when you're yelling at a 40-year-old, not a 14-year-old? I think it's very challenging. I really do. Hey, those of you that want to continue to comment on this, you're welcome to. Ted Widmer, noted historian, librarian, musician, and an author who has written the only book I've been able to find about Martin Van Buren, joins me straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This is Greg Kelly. To my friends in the construction business, if you've been injured on the job, make just one call to the construction accident lawyers at the law offices of Darren T. Moore. With hundreds of five-star reviews, they fight for more justice for every client and have secured millions of dollars in compensation for New York construction workers. Call 888-444-ATTY. That's 888-444-2889 for a free consultation. More diligence, more persistence, and more justice. Prior results don't guarantee similar outcomes.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. You know me, I am a sucker for presidential history. I don't consider myself an expert in presidential history by any stretch, but I do consider myself very much a student of presidential history. And now that it looks like we are facing a Trump versus Biden rematch, I've been going back and looking at all of the other presidential rematches, going all the way back to the first one that we've ever had, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, to the most recent, Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson. And, you know, everyone talks about Jefferson and Adams and how they became friends and how they became, letter writing pen pals. Then we've spent a little bit of time talking about John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson. Both men left an indelible mark on 19th century America. But then I went back and I have to tell you, I don't know that I realized this was a presidential rematch. If I did, then I had forgotten it. In 1836 and 1840, we saw Martin Van Buren and William Henry Harrison face off against each other twice. And both men, pretty interesting. Both campaigns were pretty interesting. And Martin Van Buren's life was pretty interesting. His life is pretty interesting, not only because in recent he's become mentioned in pop culture more than most 19th century presidents, but his life is also pretty interesting in that as an ex-president, he made repeated comeback attempts, ran as a third party candidate, sought to get a major party nomination again. So I became very interested in going down this Martin Van Buren rabbit hole, and I thought maybe you might be too. So I was able to find one of the nation's foremost experts on all things Martin Van Buren. I am very pleased to welcome to the program distinguished historian Ted Widmer, who is also the author of Martin Van Buren, the American President series, The Eighth President. Ted, it's great to have you on the program. Good to talk to you.
You too, Frank. I'm so happy to be in this rabbit hole with you.
So how did you get interested in Martin Van Buren? There are a lot of books about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, a lot of interest in people like the Roosevelts. I don't know that if you asked a sixth grader to do a book report on a president, that they would necessarily pick your book and your president. How did you pick Van Buren?
Well, a short answer is it was assigned to me. I met Arthur Schlesinger Jr., great presidential historian. He was putting together a series of short books on every president, and he assigned me Van Buren. And there was a reason. I had done a book earlier than that on New York City in the 1840s and 50s. I was interested in the history of New York City. I didn't really want to do Van Buren. I thought it basically signaled my ranking as a historian near the bottom to be assigned Van Buren. But then, you know, I started working on it. It was fascinating. I thought there was a lot more to him than I first assumed. And he had a rich life. He had a very interesting life before he was president. He had a rough 4 years as president, but then, like you said, he came back, or he tried to come back many times, and he had a pretty big life. So I really enjoyed the project. I'm grateful to Arthur Schlesinger for assigning it to me. And I'm so delighted 20 years later to be talking about him with you. I think he's relevant.
Well, I'm going to ask you how and why in a minute, but educate folks a little bit about who Martin Van Buren was as a person. Now, a great presidential trivia question, which I've gotten a number of times, and I used to always get wrong, now I always get right, is he was the only American president that spoke English as a second language. What do we know about his upbringing, and what was his upbringing like?
Well, he was a poor kid, and that was new. We've had a number since then, including Abraham Lincoln, pretty good president. But he grew up in a small town called Kinderhook, New York. It's on the eastern bank of the Hudson River, kind of near Albany. And his father ran a tavern, just like a place travelers would stop. And he was a smart kid. He didn't go to college, but he just sort of, you know, listened and learned and became very interested in New York state politics and just kept running and winning higher and higher offices and ultimately got to governor of New York and then senator from New York, went to Washington, D.C. and became close to Andrew Jackson. That's a long story, but Jackson liked him so much, he made him his vice president for his second term, and that meant he was teed up to become president when Jackson retired after two terms. And so in 1837, he becomes the eighth president of the United States, and it was sort of mind-boggling for someone who'd just grown up, ordinary poor kid in upstate New York.
So all the stories that they teach us in school, that any poor American child can grow up to be president, Martin Van Buren was the truth behind the myth.
He was. The ones before him were not really. They were people like Thomas Jefferson who talked about the importance of democracy and how anyone could rise up to a high level. But in fact, they were all either former soldiers like George Washington or large land owners. John Adams, he wasn't a very wealthy man, but he wasn't poor either. And he was certainly very well educated and was different from Van Buren. So Van Buren is a new kind of 19th century American. And he also is the first president born after the American Revolution. So he's the first one born in the United States as a new country. And in a lot of ways, he really was a new kind of president.
We're talking with Ted Widmer, a historian and the author of Martin Van Buren from the American President series. That book's still available on Amazon if you're interested in picking it up. Ted, one of the things that I know about Van Buren is his nickname, Old Kinderhook. Anyone that has seen the film Silver Linings Playbook knows that there's a bit of presidential trivia involving Van Buren in that picture, where Bradley Cooper basically says that the term that we all use probably a dozen times a day, okay, comes from Martin Van Buren and Old Kinderhook.
You know where the term okay comes from?
No, I don't.
Where?
Well, Martin Van Buren, the eighth president of the United States of America, is from Kinderhook, New York. Oh. And he was part of the club, a men's club, called Old Kinderhook. And if you were cool, you were in the club, you'd say that guy's okay. Because he's in the old Kinderhooks.
Really?
Yeah. Pretty cool, right?
Is that true? Is Bradley Cooper's version of history accurate? Do we get okay from Martin Van Buren?
I think so. I believe so. There's no first you can pinpoint, but it becomes very popular around 1840. There are a couple explanations. One is Ol Kinderhook, O-L apostrophe Kinderhook. And another is Ol Correct. It's like a Dutch form for Dutch phrase for everything's okay. Like, that's what it is. Ol Correct means like everything is right. And it's just a comfortable phrase that gets attached to Van Buren. He's also called the Careful Dutchman. He has a lot of nicknames, and it's just a funny way to refer to him in 18. Yeah, I think it is correct.
You alluded to his working and professional relationship with Andrew Jackson. Clearly, he was a big Andrew Jackson supporter. He was the vice president in Jackson's second term. How involved in Jackson's administration was Van Buren? We've certainly seen vice presidents that have been not at all involved in their president's administration, and then other vice presidents that were very much involved. What did he actually do, if anything, as vice president?
I think very. I don't think Jackson loved legislation. I don't think he loved hobnobbing with politicians. I think they annoyed him. He's this like volatile and charismatic former general, and Van Buren was more the guy to like go over and get the guy who didn't want to vote your way to change his mind. He was a good negotiator, and also he brought the North into the Jacksonian coalition. I mean, that they figured out together that the South and New York State together would be a formidable combination, which it was, and that really is the origin of the Democratic Party. It's often traced to Thomas Jefferson, but what he created was very different, and I think Van Buren creates the modern Democratic Party the way, you know, FDR would have recognized it or John F. Kennedy. It's a party of the northern working men and southerners and generally pretty liberal, and I think a lot of that is Van Buren.
All right. This is, I find, an unfair question of any president, because there are so many positive aspects and negative aspects of any presidential administration, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. Was Martin Van Buren a good president? And if you can elaborate on that a bit, what did he actually do as president?
Well, I have to be honest, even though, you know, I'm mostly defending him, he had a very hard 4 years as president. Some of it was bad luck. I think most of it was bad luck. So immediately after he took the oath of office, there was a financial depression, which he was powerless to prevent from happening. And probably Andrew Jackson had teed it up for him in a way, with some of his financial policies, which restricted the circulation of money in the economy. But also there were a lot of problems coming in fast and furious. And another one was that the slavery argument was really accelerating. And that was a hard one for him. In his early career, he didn't really want to go there. He wanted to built this coalition between the South and New York State. And so to be abolitionist would have harmed that goal. Later in his career, after his presidency, he was pretty outspoken on slavery in ways that I think were impressive. But during his presidency, it was just it was like a third rail that he did not want to touch. And it just polarized the nation. And then as he was running for re-election, he was outmaneuvered by a Whig party. That was the other party in that era that had sort of learned from him the arts of electioneering and had a great slogan, a great song, lots of paper products about William Henry Harrison, his opponent, who they called Tippecanoe. And they had sort of stories about him sitting in a log cabin with a jug of whiskey. And that was very popular. And so Van Buren basically just came in, had a financial depression, a lot of tension over slavery, and then didn't run as well in his reelection campaign as his opponent. So the 4 years went by quickly, and there is no great legislative achievement. There are some small things. He sent out a very important scientific expedition across the Pacific Ocean. Americans were already exploring around the world, and he sent out an important group of ships to learn from the Pacific Ocean. And some pro-labor legislation, minor things, but there is no great major achievement of the Van Buren presidency.
And so I know he won that 1836 election pretty handily. 1840, it sounds like he lost through a combination of poor conditions in the country, out campaigning by the other side, and some poor decisions on his part. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. The country did start to rebound from the Depression. I mean, so he was doing his job. He was doing everything he could to rebuild confidence. But this is a long time before Franklin Roosevelt, and there was no sense of how a president could jumpstart the economy. Economic matters were a mystery to most presidents in the 19th century. So he just had to kind of hire people here and there where he could, and try to get senators and congressmen to work with him. And eventually things did turn around, but not quickly. I mean, most of the 4 years of his presidency, the country was really suffering from a very severe depression, and politically things were not going well because the South was getting angrier and angrier, and Texas was about to come into the country, which we now think of as, you know, something that was obviously going to happen, but at the time probably meant that we were going to have a war with Mexico. So there were very severe tensions that were just sort of coming in fast and furious, and he had trouble getting ahead of them.
One of the things that we alluded to was his comeback attempts, trying to get renominated from the Democratic Party in the year that James K. Polk was nominated, 1844. But he also tried to run as a third party candidate with the Free Soil Party. A lot of presidents don't do that. Even the ones that that come close, even the ones that leave office relatively young, they choose to retire, maybe write their memoirs, and in some cases make some money. What drove Van Buren in his post-presidency? Why did he keep trying to come back and get elected?
It's a good question. It's true. It hadn't happened before. And usually when you're put out to pasture, you just go. But he kept coming back. And I think part of it was he was angry after, in 1844, he felt he had a right to run again. And the southern part of the Democratic Party wouldn't give it to him. And so there's a kind of break happening in the Democratic Party 16 years before the Civil War happens. But already the South is getting strong, and they don't want people like Van Buren in their Democratic Party. So he got shut down at the Democratic Convention of 1844, and he and his supporters were very, very frustrated. So 4 years later, in 1848, he saw a window, and he ran as a third-party candidate for a party called the Free Soil Party, anti-slavery. And that was a shock to a lot of people, because he'd been so conciliatory to the South for so many years, even though he was a Northerner. And finally, he just was fed up. He's like, I slavery is terrible. We don't want it spreading into the West. And I like that about it. It's like an angry older Van Buren. And I like that Van Buren. He didn't come close to winning, but he did manage to, by running as a third Party candidate, he denied the pro-Southern Democratic candidate in 1848, whose name was Lewis Cass. He lost because of Van Buren. So.
That's really interesting. You alluded to the fact that Van Buren is still relevant today. Aside from the fact that we have a former president running to reclaim his old job, why? Why does Van Buren still matter in 2024?
Well, I do think he built the modern Democratic Party, you know, for all of its strengths and weaknesses. It's a great national party. The founders did not see parties in the future of the country. They were geniuses, but they did not like parties very much. And in the Federalist Papers, Madison and Hamilton talked about how faction was a bad thing, that we want to avoid factions. We want to just have like perfect checks and balances. And Van Buren comes along a generation later and thinks, no, I think a great national party will be a good thing, and it will help especially the lower ranking people in this country, the farmers and the, you know, more and more people lived in cities and were working in hard jobs in cities. And Van Buren wanted to bring them into the national conversation. So he built a Democratic Party that I do think you can see in Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and in the, you know, the heyday of the Democratic Party, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, the Great Society. There are echoes of Van Buren in all of those great society programs for working men and health care and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. You know, those were more sophisticated than Van Buren could have realized, but he wanted a big party to help working Americans. And so I think in that way, he's relevant. But also, as a politician who just sort of stayed alert and listened to his conscience and got better, his presidency wasn't great, but his afterlife politically was pretty impressive. And I think the way he sort of came around and opposed slavery in his older life was pretty good. So I just found him surprising. And that's a nice thing to say. We don't want to just be bored by our presidents and think they're cardboard figures that we have to memorize. Here was a living, thinking person who kept trying to get better himself and to make his country better. And so I ended up enjoying my time with him, even though, I mean, I confessed to you I didn't really want to write about him.
Fair enough.
But I ended up admiring him, and I'm glad I did the book.
That's terrific. We've been talking with Ted Widmer. Ted, I know it's late. I'm going to let you go in a moment. Two quick questions I have to ask you before we end. One, you know, normally I would ask someone in your position, what is the best book on Van Buren other than yours? But honestly, I looked for other Van Buren biographies, and I didn't find any. Are there other Van Buren biographies aside from yours?
That's a funny question, Frank. There's a big one by a guy named John Niven. It's out of print, but it's good. I liked it. I mentioned Arthur Schlesinger asked me to do the book, and he wrote a great book about it's called The Age of Jackson. So the time of Andrew Jackson's presidency, but it includes Van Buren's also. It's, you know, about from 1825 to 1845. And it's a fantastic book. It's a big, rich, colorful book about America, all of its strength and heroism and all of its narcissism and its problems. And I read that early in grad school and loved it. And so it was such a joy for me to come back to working with Arthur Schlesinger, because his book about the Age of Jackson really got me excited about history in the first place. So it's an older book, but I think it still says a lot to people who are interested in how do we get from the Revolution to the Civil War.
Also, those of us that are Seinfeld fans are very familiar with Kramer's explanation of the vicious gang known as the Van Buren Boys.
So there I am at Lorenzo's, loading up my slice at the fixin's bar. Garlic and whatnot. When I see this guy over at the pizza box is giving me the stink eye. So I give him the crook eye back, you know? Then I notice that he's not alone. I'm taking on the entire Van Buren Boys.
Van Buren Boys?
Yeah.
There's a street gang named after President Martin Van Buren?
Oh, yeah. And they're just as mean as he was. So I make a move to the door, you know, whoop, they block it. So I lunge for the bathroom. I grab the knob. Occupy them. And they back me up against the cartoon map of Italy. And all of a sudden, they just stop.
What happened?
Because I'm still holding the garlic shaker. You know, like this. I'm only showing 8 fingers.
Well, what does that mean?
That's their secret sign. See, Van Buren, he was the 8th president. They thought I was a former Van B boy.
Wow. How was the pizza?
Oh, it was a little oily.
Is there really, to the best of your knowledge, a gang dedicated to Martin Van Buren?
I'm making the symbol, Frank, as we're talking of the 8 fingers that Kramer does. But no, I think that was all made up, but it was absolutely brilliant comedy, and I loved it. But no, I don't think there is a group called the Van Buren. I mean, you and I, we could start something.
I would never be part of any club that would want me as a member. Ted,
yeah.
It's great to have you on the program. Thank you for staying up late. I hope we can talk again soon.
Me too. Thanks so much, Frank.
Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-9222, 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
Other Side of Midnight. It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Before the top of the hour, this is The Other Side of Midnight. We are playing as much disco today as we can in honor of my friend Curtis Sliwa's 70th birthday. He was very much a disco dancing extraordinaire. It might be a little bit of a stretch, but he did, you know, of all the things that Curtis has sought to ban over the years that are fun, alcohol, drugs, I'm sure tobacco at some point. The one thing he's never been in favor of banning is dancing. Even when there was the big to-do over the cabaret laws, he was never in favor of banning dancing. That's because he is a dancer's dancer, that's for sure. All right, 800-848-9222. I saw the new Curb Your Enthusiasm last night. My wife and I enjoyed it very much. I'm not going to give anyway any spoilers, only to say that that I just had some cheese, which made me think about it, is that there is an important cheese component to this. I will just say that. It doesn't give away anything from the plot. And there's some fun guest appearances as well. Robert is in Manhattan. Hi, Robert.
Good morning, Frank. I was fascinated by your interview with the author of the Van Buren information, but I'm a little confused by some history. Am I correct? Did Van Buren #1 have any policy pro or negative about the annexation of Texas. Remember, Texas had become independent in 1836, and for almost 10 years it was an independent republic. And I'm certain, I know Jackson wanted Texas admitted to the Union. What was Van Buren's?
He was opposed to annexing Texas because he thought, he knew that it would add another slave territory, and he felt that it also might bring war with Mexico. He was opposed to annexing Texas.
Okay, the second question I have, am I correct that the Indian removal was completed by Jackson's second administration, or did the forced removal of the civilized tribes as well as others east of the Mississippi continue during Van Buren's administration?
I would have to look into that, but I don't believe it did. I think that was done under Jackson, but I'd have to check on that, honestly. Meantime, now's as good a time to mention, keep asking questions.